Every year, the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film is chosen from movies nominated by their home countries, one submission per country. This year's Mexican submission is Miss Bala, a story set amidst Mexico's drug war. Miss Bala is opening in American theaters this week, and our critic-at-large John Power says that it grippingly captures a society shot through with fear.
If you read the headlines, you know that the Mexican government is engaged in a long, deadly battle against the country's astonishingly powerful drug dealers, known as narcotraficantes, or simply narcos. Hardly a day goes by without news of another shootout or massacre. Nearly 50,000 people have died in the current five-year-old drug war, the majority of them innocent citizens. Naturally, such a reality has a painful effect on the psyches of ordinary people forced to live amidst the madness. And this is the subject of a remarkable new movie, Miss Bala, written and directed by the brilliant young Mexican filmmaker Gerardo Naranjo. Focusing on the absurd travails of one young woman, this searing, exaggerated, sometimes weirdly funny film plays like a cross between Franz Kafka and No Country for Old Men. Set in and around Tijuana in the northern Mexican state of Baja, Miss Bala tells the story of Laura Guerrero, played by Stephanie Sigmund, a pretty, innocent 23-year-old whose family runs a clothes stall. Laura has big dreams, and to make them come true, she enters the Miss Baja beauty pageant. So far, so good. But after entering, she follows her friend Suzu to a disco, and there things go terribly wrong. Narcos burst in and start gunning people down. Laura escapes, just barely. But when she tries to find out what happened to Suzu, she makes a fateful mistake. She asks the help of a policeman. Before she knows it, she's in the hands of Lino Valdez, a dangerously capricious drug boss played by Noe Hernandez. Laura desperately wants to get away, but there's nowhere safe to go. And so Lino uses her to perform tasks she doesn't want to do for men whose intentions she rarely understands. All she knows is that wherever she turns up, people get killed. Laura goes from hoping to be Miss Baja to becoming Miss Bala, which is Spanish for bullet. Now, there are a lot of bullets in Miss Bala, but part of what makes the film so masterful is its striking way of portraying violence. You see, most violent movie scenes are shot and edited to make the killing and mayhem as exciting as possible. The camera, we might say, encourages us to identify with the violence, either by making it seem cool or by focusing on a hero whose own violence we're urged to cheer on. Naranjo does just the opposite. While his movie is very exciting, there are three riveting set pieces, he keeps us focused on the point of view of Laura, who's a victim. Using superbly orchestrated long takes, he either shows us what Laura's seeing, or more often, simply focuses on her face as murderous events unfold around her. The soul of the film is her fear. In Laura's face, we see the terror and dread that have become normal in a Mexico where the drug trade touches everyone and everything, even a goofy Miss Baja contest. When I first saw Miss Bala, I kept thinking that Laura was too passive and that Sigmund needed to show more fire in her performance. Watching it again, I realized I'd been expecting her to be the heroine of a Hollywood movie. But Laura's not. She's a not-rich young woman living in a place where, if you're a not-rich young woman in trouble, there's nowhere to go and no one to trust. You never know who that cop is really working for, or whether that famous general in charge of fighting a cartel may himself be one of its bosses. Pointedly over the top, Miss Bala offers a vision of Mexico that must surely have the National Tourist Board clutching its collective head in dismay. After all, just as there was more to life in Miami than you saw in the old Al Pacino movie Scarface, there's obviously far more to this country of 120 million people than drug dealers, corrupt officials, and their victims. Yet the fact that Naranjo's movie is his country's official Oscar nominee suggests that, while it may not tell the whole story of Mexican life, it clearly captures a reality nobody can deny. Early on, when Laura tells her father she's going to enter the Miss Baja contest, he urges her not to. He says she could wind up in trouble, making it clear that it's better to keep your head down. It sounds like good advice, but the painful truth is that this good advice wouldn't have helped Laura at all. In the Mexico of Miss Bala, you can never get your head down far enough.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. You can see the trailer for Miss Bala on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. And it's great to put producer Anne-Marie Baldonado back in the credits. She's just returned from her maternity leave.
A couple of months ago, we heard on this program about the proliferation of buy-here, pay-here used car dealerships. Ken Bensinger of the Los Angeles Times reported on dealerships that don't just sell cars, they also make the loans to pay for them. They're often the only dealers where people with bad credit can get a car. Interest rates are high, repossessions are common, and a single used car can be a cash cow once it's sold multiple times. Recently, Bensinger did a follow-up to that investigation, how buy-here, pay-here dealers handle used car leasing. And he joins us now from Los Angeles. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
And first, what have you found about how common it is for these dealerships to get into leasing used cars, either in addition to or instead of selling them?
It's a much newer business model. It's probably only about 5 or 10 years old in most parts of the country. And the numbers aren't very specific, but the largest company that offers insurance to these dealers told me they have about 2,500 dealers, I think, operating now, and that's up almost double in the last 3 years.
Well, from the dealer's standpoint, what's in it to lease a car to me? Let's say I'm a buyer. What's in it to lease to me as opposed to sell it to me?
Well, dealers invented this idea of leasing used cars. And I should add that new cars have been leased for decades, but no one ever wanted to touch used cars until some of these low-end used car dealers figured out that by leasing, rather than selling cars, they gained all kinds of advantages over the consumer. They found it was easier to repossess them. Rules protecting assets in bankruptcy did not apply to these. Rules capping interest rates in different states also did not apply. And they found that there was tax advantages on both state and federal income taxes and sales taxes.
You mean the difference being here that title doesn't actually change hands and the amount of the lease is not technically an interest rate?
That's exactly right. And if you do the math on these leases, there's no interest rate stated on the contract. But if you do the math, you'll see interest rates typically around 35 to 45%.
35 to 45%.
That's about right.
Well, let's assume that I'm a buyer. I have no money, no credit, and I want to buy a car. Would I have to make a down payment typically to buy an old Toyota, let's say?
To buy an old Toyota, you'd have to make a down payment. To lease it, you'd have to make what they might call an origination fee or an application fee or a security deposit. And the difference is that that doesn't go towards your ownership of the car. That's simply a fee that the dealer can pocket.
I've always thought that one advantage of leasing, which I've never done with a new car, is that you lease it during the period of the early years of the car's life. It's less likely to need big repairs than if you leased, say, a five-year-old car. The company you're taking the lease from would be responsible for servicing it. Is that the case here?
No. These cars, there's no guarantees as to their condition, and many contracts actually require the customer to maintain it themselves and frequently require them to do the maintenance at the maintenance operation owned by the dealership.
Well, trying to look at this from the consumer's standpoint, does the consumer who leases as opposed to buys from one of these dealerships, is there any advantage at all?
Well, the consumer who's attracted to these typically is interested because it's easy to get off the lot with not a lot of upfront money. The down payments tend to be slightly lower than buy-here, pay-here down payments. And so they think simply, how much cash do I have in my pocket today and what can I drive off the lot with? They think that way because they desperately need a car to get to work. Let's remember that this is an industry that looks for people who need a car. These aren't luxury items. These are tools that are utterly important for getting and holding down a job. The monthly payments in these leases tend to be the same or higher than in buy-here, pay-here loans. That's a contrast with new car leasing, where leasing tends to be cheaper on a monthly basis. And the worst part is at the end, you still don't own the car. You have to make a huge balloon payment if you actually want to own it.
Ken Bensinger, thanks for talking with us once again.
It's been a great pleasure.
That's business reporter Ken Bensinger of the Los Angeles Times.
This is NPR News.
And now we can tell you what could be the final chapter in a long saga for the Japanese automaker Toyota. Yet another report shows electronics in Toyota and Lexus cars were not to blame for reports of unintended acceleration. NPR's Sonari Glinton has more.
In 2009 and 2010, Toyota recalled more than 8 million vehicles worldwide. That's after reports of sudden unintended acceleration. Those reports and subsequent news coverage caused one of the biggest public relations nightmares in the company's history. Since 2009, Toyota has lost its position as the world's largest automaker. It faced lawsuits and its executives were called to testify before Congress. The Department of Transportation and NASA investigated. They looked at what's called the electronic throttle control. That's what sends information from the accelerator to the engine. Neither could find evidence that the electronics were to blame for the problem. What was likely to blame were sticky gas pedals or floor mats that might jam. And finally, the possibility that drivers could have been mistaking the gas pedal for the brakes. An independent panel found this week that no fatalities occurred because of the car's electronics. The panel did recommend that regulators require data recorders to be put in the vehicles. They also recommended that the government look into placement and design of foot pedals. That's to find ways to make it harder to mistake the gas for the brake, not just for Toyota, but for all car companies. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, poetry may have an important place in literary history, but does it have a future? We'll hear about efforts to bring new life to that art form. That's a little later in the program. But first, we want to revisit the story about that controversial Mexican-American studies program that was suspended earlier this month in Tucson, Arizona's public schools. That came after Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, John Hoopenthal, found the courses in violation of state law, a law that he in fact helped write. The law bans, among other things, classes that can cause, quote, resentment towards other races or groups of people. We spoke with Mr. Hoopenthal yesterday, and he said the classes violated the rule. I want to play a short clip of our lengthy conversation.
To tell young kids that they can't get ahead, that they're victims in a country in which Barack Obama was president, it defies what we know. We know that you can engage in America. You can get ahead, that these kids can succeed.
If you want to hear the entire interview, just go to our website, go to npr.org and select Tell Me More from the Programs tab. We thought it was important to get a different perspective, so we've called upon Adelita Grijalva. She is a member of the Tucson Unified School Board, and she cast the lone vote in support of the program after Mr. Hoopenthal's decision, and she is with us now. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, you had the opportunity to hear our conversation with Mr. Hoopenthal, and I just wanted to ask, when you first heard these questions raised about the Mexican-American Studies program, and this dispute has been going on for some time now, what was your reaction?
Initially, our reaction was, we're in compliance with the law. In the law, it highlights areas that would be in violation of the law, like promoting the overthrow of the government, promoting ethnic solidarity, promoting design for one ethnic group. And I thought, you know, these classes are not out of compliance with those. So our initial stance was, we're not out of compliance, whether we agree or disagree with the law. I mean, that was going to be our position. And so initially there was an audit. We did an internal audit of the program, and there were found to be no issues. And that's when the data started coming out that the students in Mexican American Studies in TUSD are more likely to graduate high school, do better in AIMS, and go on to higher education than students that are not taking these courses. And so I think that that's important to highlight, and one of the reasons why these programs were initially created was a response to the mandates of No Child Left Behind, to basically address the issue that minority children have lower academic success than their non-minority counterparts.
Well, that was actually going to be my next question, mm-hmm. which is, what do you think the benefit of these courses has been or is or would be? Well, the courses have been suspended, so what do you think the primary benefit of them has been?
Essentially, 11 years later, we started this program in 2002, and 11 years later, we have created a program that does meet the needs of these children and is showing academic gains in all subject areas, even if, you know, the classes that they're taking are a history course or a literature course, their math scores, reading scores, everything else is improved. And they're going to college at a higher rate than their non-Mexican-American studies peers.
Well, Mr. Hoopenthal disputes those gains, so let's set that aside because we can't resolve that here. What about the substance of his argument and the argument of his predecessor, a state superintendent, that these courses create a sense of grievance, that they create a sense of victimization, and that they spur resentment among particularly the Mexican-American students taking them toward their white peers and toward the society at large. How do you respond to that?
You know, I really feel like, on the contrary, the courses teach our students that they can rise up over any obstacle, over any form of oppression. It discusses what the Mexican-American experience has been in our history. The students leave basically believing that they can not only change their lives, but they can change the world. These classes show, you know, these students that they have a right to an education, a right to vote, a right to equal protections that generations before them fought for, and they should take advantage of those opportunities.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about that dispute over that now suspended Mexican-American Studies program in Tucson, Arizona schools. Our guest is Adelita Grijalva. She cast the lone vote on the Tucson School Board to preserve the program after the state school superintendent voted to suspend it at the risk of, it needs to be said, millions of dollars in financial penalties if the school board failed to suspend the program. We heard from the state superintendent on yesterday's program. So why do you think that these classes became the object of concern?
It really comes down to a guest speaker that one of our high schools, Tucson High, had during Cesar Chavez Week. And Dolores Huerta made a statement that we put on our website. As you know, she was a guest speaker. It was put on our website, and different people heard it and reported it as an issue. And one of the comments that she made was, Republicans hate Latinos. And so Tom Horn, who was then the superintendent of schools, came down with his right-hand person, Margaret Dugan, who is a Republican and is Latina, and wanted to speak to the children to address that issue. And so they were obviously allowed into the school. Students came into an assembly, and students asked, can we ask questions? Because usually they just raise their hand up and ask questions. And Mr. Horn said, you write the questions down, I will review the questions, and I'll pick out questions I want to ask. And so the students felt that they were being censored. And so they did a political demonstration. They put tape over their mouth and stood up during the presentation. And he felt that was incredibly disrespectful and tied it back to these classes and the things that they were learning.
Yeah, we asked about that. I asked Mr. Hubenthal about that, and he kind of acknowledged that it was partly about that, but he said it's bigger than that. You think that sort of all these years later, it's about that one assembly?
I do. I think that that started it, started the ball rolling, and then there were some exchanges between TUSD and the state, because TUSD has always felt that this is an issue of local control, and we should decide as a school district what curriculum takes place in our classes. And so up until January, there was not a willingness on the majority of the board to change or cease offering these courses. And so really, that just happened in January. And I think that, unfortunately, I have colleagues on the board that don't see the value, that feel like history isn't being taught with a balanced view. Well, I wonder how you teach some of these parts of our history without being one-sided. I mean, how do you talk about the fact that there is a sign that is in one of our picture books that students can no longer access that says, no Mexicans or dogs allowed? That is a picture that was taken in a part of our history. And I feel like, unfortunately, we're moving in a direction in this country where we're rewriting history and eliminating or downplaying the unsavory parts that we don't want to remember.
Adelita Grijalva is a member of the Tucson Unified School District, and she was kind enough to join us from her office in Tucson, Arizona. Ms. Grijalva, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. The British arm of Rupert Murdoch's media empire reached an out-of-court settlement today. More than three dozen people will receive payments, including celebrities, politicians, and crime victims. Their phones were illegally hacked by the News of the World tabloid. Despite the settlement, as Vicky Barker reports from London, this is not the end of the scandal.
Among those accepting civil damages today were Britain's former Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott and actor Jude Law. In a statement issued after the hearing, Law described for the first time a campaign of phone hacking and round-the-clock surveillance that lasted 3 years. No corner of his family's, or his friends' private lives had been out of bounds to the hackers, he said. Law settled for $200,000. Chris Bryant, a lawmaker for the opposition Labour Party, accepted $45,000. Like Law, the Member of Parliament insisted this was never about the money.
The most important thing is that finally News International are beginning to let us see the hem of the truth. We don't know the full truth yet. We won't know that until people are up in court before another judge. for criminal proceedings.
If the Murdoch company's lawyers were hoping to avoid a trial, they failed. 10 of the victims refused to settle, including singer Charlotte Church. And the information gleaned from those who did settle has proved invaluable, says lawyer Tamsin Allen.
The impact of these claims has been to uncover the nature and scale of the conspiracy to hack phones at the News of the World.
A police investigation into the phone hacking scandal is still underway. A criminal trial may yet follow the civil one. Also underway, the official inquiry led by Lord Justice Leveson. It's been exploring the privacy and regulatory issues raised by the scandal, as well as whether the police got too cozy with the tabloids. The damages announced today run to about $1 million, but the Murdoch empire's final bill will be much higher because, by admitting liability, it's now also liable for the victim's legal costs. Lawyers for the plaintiffs say the company effectively acknowledged that senior employees and directors knew about the wrongdoing. News International apologized in court, but the company said it would have no further comment on today's settlements. For NPR News, I'm Vicky Barker in London.